up this month. What is your assessment of these elections?
There is now a popular boycott for this election. We are showing that we want a new constitution, like real constitution, like legal constitution, which represent the original Bahrainese people, not that one which was written by Hamad's arm only, which is against the people. So about that election, regime used this election just for view to international propaganda for the international community. See, especially for people and for the government in London and the United States. See, Bahrain is a democratic country. There is election, free election. And at the same time, doesn't allow that regime people from UN anyway to visit the prison in Bahrain, the prisoner, to see the situation. Just Al Khalifa used that media, because we don't have all the media in Bahrain is Al Khalifa by it, is under Al Khalifa influence. So for that election is not legal, because if you will say the leaders which are the president, which they are the president in the jail in Bahrain, so they are presented the majority of Bahrain, and Hamad, he knows that.
Well, what does it mean for you when the regime has taken away your citizenship?
You know, of course, it's unfair. I am a medical doctor. I work as a doctor in Bahrain. I just spoke. I saw the injuries, the dead people, murders from my eyes at the ground. I rescued many injuries. So Al Khalifa, they want to punish me. Actually, I was in Lebanon that time. I saw on Al Arabiya TV breaking news that Al Khalifa took citizenship from me, from myself, and my others, the Bahrainis. So it is not easy. But you know, the connect between me and Bahrain, not just this red passport, this route. Al Khalifa, they are not Bahrainis. They invade Bahrain 2 centuries or 200 years. It is not easy. But in the same time, you know that I am Bahrainis. My father is Bahraini. Grandfather are Bahrainis. So if you took from my citizenship, it's not me that I'm not Bahraini. So he treating us now just like this. If you say, if I don't like your idea, I will take your citizenship. More than 500 or 600 people without this citizenship. But practically, there is thousands of people, because I simply, you go to the airport, you want to go to Al Arba'in, to Iraq, you are not allowed. You want to visit Imam Rida in Iran, you are not allowed. There is Geneva conference or for human rights, you are not allowed to go there. So practically, people without citizenship. So that is situations, I hope that I ask many times that regime, the media, give me one reason why you took from me my citizenship. I will agree with you. One reason. Okay, I'm not criminal. I am just doctor in politics. Did you take my citizenship because I'm a doctor? I rescue people in Bahrain. So that's the situation for the other. And this is, see now, our kids, they are stateless. There's a new generation without citizenship. And this is that view, the world knows that view, but the problem that Al Khalifa continue to do this thing. Just they want to see that. See, you demonstrate in 2011, you're not allowed to be Bahraini. That's the message from Al Khalifa. They want us to be like Abid, like just to say, what he wants. But actually, that steps won't help him, because people of Bahrain, generation after generation, they are more aggressive against this regime.
Wow, that's an unbelievable, very sad situation in Bahrain. Thank you so much for being with us here, Dr. Al-Aradi. It is interesting how King Hamad has tried to get various international entities on board with his modernization disguise. Even the Pope will be visiting Bahrain in November. He and others have been invited by the Bahraini royal family to participate In a conference themed Bahrain Forum for Dialogue, East and West for Human Coexistence. Well, many Bahrainis find the theme slightly ironic when they feel that the government does not want its own people to peacefully coexist and thrive. Bahraini prisoners, as well as some of those in exile, have written letters to Pope Francis and informing him that Hamad simply wants to put on a show for the world that everything is fine in Bahrain and that he believes in inclusivity, when that is the farthest thing from reality in Bahrain today. Here's an excerpt from the prisoner's letter to the Pope.
Bahrain's prisoner's letter to the Pope. Your Holiness, Pope Francis, we speak to you on behalf of more than 4,000 political prisoners from the people of this island, imprisoned throughout the years since the events of the 2011 Arab Spring. Some of them served their sentences and were released without redress. Some died without compensation. Some were killed without any investigation. Some are awaiting execution without any intercession, while others will never be freed, sentenced to life, after being handed down ridiculously long prison terms. Abdul Rauf Al-Shaib. Dr. Abdul Rauf Al-Shaib has been a human rights defender for more than 40 years. In 2006, Al-Shaib founded Bahrain Salvation Movement, Harakat Khalas. He is currently the head of the National Committee for Martyrs and Victims of Torture in Bahrain. Stripped of his citizenship, Al-Shaib has been sentenced to death. He's also been sentenced to prison in absentia for more than 130 years.
Well, thanks so much for being with me. We're happy to have with us here in the studio Dr. Abdul Rauf Al-Shaib. I'm so happy you being with us. Tell me a little bit about yourself. Let's start from there.
When I was still young, between 14 to 15 years old, I start feeling that there is a discrimination in Bahrain against majority of people there, which is Shia. And also by the revolution of Iran, we start having some idea that there is a political religion where we can use a religion to apply a government or to have an Islamic rule. So that's why we start having that knowledge and we start doing some practice and activity, pushing people for Islam back to go to Islam. From that years, I have been in prison with the government only because we were supporting Islamic ideology and idea about the government. So they put me for 5 years in jail. Again, after that, also again for 5 years. Until means I have spent between Saudi Arabia imprisonment and Bahrain imprisonment and UK as well imprisonment for more than 18 years.
Oh my God.
Only for my activities defending human rights.
So you said that, okay, so Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, doing human rights activities, you're in prison. But what happened in UK? Why were you in prison there too?
The same things. Means I feel that there is some pressure on UK government from Saudi Arabia and from Bahrain because of my activity. So they fabricate for me a case about a media that there is some information in your laptop that can support who were planning to attend a terrorism act, which is all fake, all means the judgment about your heart, about your soul, that you might have that plan in the future. So we have put you in prison for that.
Tell me your perspective right now. What is life like for the Bahraini people today?
I feel since Al Khalifa, they came on stage to rule Bahrain. It's still the same, but it goes worse and worse by the time. Means, let's say, the father of this king in Bahrain right now was a little bit better than him, and his grandfather better than his father. So the more we are going for the generation down, the more they get worse. It means they become more dictatorship. They become more oppression against the and aggressive against our nation there in Bahrain. So there is a very wide discrimination against the people in Bahrain. They use them like slaves. And that's why we don't have our right. That's why we stand to ask people's support, that we have to get our independence from this government and to rule ourselves by the means constitution we have.
We have seen recently the situation with the Bahraini government establishing ties with the Israeli regime. I want to talk about that and the effect on the Bahraini people. Do the majority of Bahrainis support this move, or how do you see this?
Absolutely not. Means the majority of Bahrainian people, whether they are Sunni or Shia, nobody supporting the government for normalization with Zionist regime. Everybody hate this regime because it's come as like a cancer in our Islamic body. So we have to get rid of the Zionist regime. But the government, although they say that we have an election, although they say we have a parliament, without asking the parliament, without having their their opinion, they are only a toys there. They put them. Nobody can even talk about Israel or about Zionists.
You just talked about the parliament, and we know that the regime has the elections coming up on November the 12th. What's your perspective about these elections?
You know, the election process itself, it doesn't give any sign or any meaning that if you have election means you have a democracy process of procedure. No. Even if we will see Hitler itself, who is bloody shit, he have that time also elections. Saddam Hussein, he was having some elections. Many of countries, a dictatorship country, who they imprisoned their people, they use election. But
so you're saying the elections are not real?
It's fake. It's fake, exactly. It's not real election. Means there is many expect that we can prove that this election doesn't represent a vote of Bahrainian people. That's why they came with that election. They use it as a makeup. The election, they use it as a makeup to beauty the ugly face of this dictatorship government.
Your final words. We know that there's an international conference that King Hamad is sponsoring that's coming up in November, and even the Pope is supposed to be there and other people. What would be your message to those individuals going to Bahrain for this conference?
First, my message for the Pope itself, because he is the top of this group who's coming in Bahrain, and he should know that by his visit to Bahrain, he is, if he mean or he doesn't mean, he is going to support this dictatorship government against his nation. And that's not the message of the Catholic Vatican. It's not the message. They said we are following the Christian and we are following Jesus. Jesus will not agree to be against one person in this world. How about nation or how about a country full of people? So that will not be acceptable. He is representing today the Pope. He is representing Jesus. And we don't believe that if Jesus was in this world, will visit Bahrain by even the call of his ruling government.
Right. Well, I would love to continue talking to you, but we're out of time. I appreciate you so much for being with us here on Hidden Files.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much.
Stay with us. I'll be right back with more of the show. as there are growing calls from Bahrainis for external pressure to be applied on the regime. The Al Khalifa family continue to work towards trying to show that everything is normal inside of the country. The regime's Western allies seem to continue to turn a blind eye to the oppression that is taking place. This is despite the United States having its fifth fleet stationed in Bahrain. So the Americans are quite aware of what is happening on the island nation. And of course, with both the United States and the United Kingdom, what we have seen is continued support for the regime and increased weapon sales to facilitate Hamid and company with its iron fist policy. And then there's Israel, and that the regime has normalized ties with the Israelis, despite the majority of Bahrainis being against the normalization of ties. Now, there's Saudi Arabia, which continues to support the regime and wants to help it change the demography of the small island nation so that the voices that may still be heard may become even more stifled. Well, perhaps participants in the upcoming conference being held in Bahrain, according to some in exile, to whitewash the reality on the ground, can serve as a forum for those who really want the truth to demand accountability. How about a visit with political prisoners to see their overall conditions? How about demanding that before Hamid reaches out to the East and the West, he reaches out to his own people and allow them to have fair representation and participation in the society? How about releasing political prisoners? How about reinstating the citizenship of so many people? How about letting the Bahraini people breathe? One person, one vote, and then watch how Bahrain could flourish if the people were given a chance to choose its own course. Well, we're hoping that eventually that will be the case, and we're keeping our eyes on Bahrain, and we're bringing you all the latest on this continued demand to end the oppression in this country. Well, that brings us to the end of this edition of Hidden Files. Make sure you join us next week and see where our files will take us to. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Goodbye.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The World Bank has predicted that the world's economy will face a sharp decline in 2023 due to soaring inflation and soaring interest rates. We take a look at some of the world media and press's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. The Reuters news agency has covered this story and tells us more. The World Bank slashed its 2023 growth forecast on Tuesday, 10th of December, to levels teetering on the brink of recession for many countries as the impact of central bank interest rate hikes intensifies. Russia's special operation in Ukraine continues, and the world's major economies' engines sputter. The development lender said it now expected global gross domestic product growth of 1.7% in 2023, the slowest pace outside the 2009 and 2020 recessions in nearly three decades. In its previous Global Economic Prospects report in June of 2022, The World Bank had forecast 2023 global growth at 3%. The bank said major slowdowns in advanced economies, including sharp cuts to its forecast to 0.5% for both the United States and the Eurozone, could foreshadow a new global recession less than 3 years after the last one. The World Bank said in a statement accompanying the report, given fragile economic conditions, any new adverse development, such as higher-than-expected inflation, abrupt rises in interest rates to contain it, a resurgence of the COVID-19 pandemic, or escalating geopolitical tensions could push the global economy into recession. The World Bank said the bleak outlook will be especially hard on emerging markets and developing economies as they struggle with heavy debt burdens, weak currencies and income growth, and slowing business investment that is now forecast at a 3.5% annual growth rate over the next 2 years, less than half the pace of the past 2 decades. World Bank President David Malpass said in a statement, weakness in growth and business investment will compound the already devastating reversals in education, health, poverty and infrastructure, and the increasing demands from climate change. The World Bank report said China's economic growth in 2022 slumped to 2.7%, its second slowest pace since the mid-1970s, after 2020, as zero COVID restrictions, property market turmoil and drought hit consumption in China. Production and investments were also lower. It predicted a rebound to 4.3% for 2023, but that is 0.9 percentage point below the June forecast due to the severity of the COVID disruptions and weakening external demand. The British newspaper The Guardian has also covered the same story and tells us more. In its half-yearly health check, the Washington-based World Bank said it had cut its 2023 growth forecast from 2.9% to 1.7% after the risk it identified 6 months ago all materialized. The World Bank's Global Economic Prospects report said the tougher-than-anticipated anti-inflationary measures, persistently high energy prices, and continued lockdowns in China had led to a much weaker outlook for this year than it had expected last summer. Almost every advanced nation and nearly 70% of emerging and developing nations have had their economic growth forecasts cut. The World Bank's mission is to reduce poverty, and its president, David Malpass, said the deterioration in the global economic outlook meant the crisis facing development was intensifying. David Malpass said, emerging and developing countries are facing a multi-year period of slow growth, driven by heavy debt burdens and weak investment, as global capital is absorbed by advanced economies, faced with extremely high government debt levels and rising interest rates. The World Bank President David Malpass added, the deterioration is broad-based. In virtually all regions of the world, per capita income growth will be slower than it was during the decade before COVID-19. The setback to global prosperity will likely persist. The World Bank said growth in the more prosperous advanced economies is projected to slow from 2.5% in 2022 to just 0.5 percentage point in 2023, adding that in the past 2 decades, slowdowns on a similar scale had resulted in global recession. Excluding China, growth in emerging market and developing economies is expected to decelerate from 3.8% in 2022 to 2.7% in 2023. The World Bank said in sub-Saharan Africa, which accounts for about 60% of the world's extremely poor, growth in per capita income over 2023-2024 is expected to average just 1.2%, a rate that could cause poverty rates to rise, not fall. In fragile and conflict-affected countries, per capita incomes are expected to decline by 2024. World Bank President David Malpass said investment growth. in emerging market and developing economies was predicted to be 3.5% a year between 2022 and 2024, half the average rate increase seen in the previous two decades. He added much-needed capital was being diverted to richer countries. The English website of Al Jazeera Television Network has also covered the same story. The head of the International Monetary Fund, IMF, warned this year will be tougher than 2022 for most of the global economy, as the United States, the European Union and China see slowing economic growth. The International Monetary Fund's managing director, Kristalina Georgieva, said 2023 will be a tough year, with one-third of the world's economies expected to be in recession. Georgieva said during the appearance of the CBS program Face the Nation, she said, because the three big economies, the United States, the European Union and China, are all slowing down simultaneously. The remarks come after the International Monetary Fund back in October cut its growth forecast to 2.7%, down from 2.9% forecast in July, amid headwinds including the war in Ukraine and sharply rising interest rates. IMF Managing Director Kristalina Georgieva said China, the world's second largest economy, is likely to grow at or below global growth for the first time in the past 40 years, as COVID-19 cases surge following the dismantling of its zero-COVID policy. Georgieva said she expected China's economic growth to improve towards the end of the year, but there are concerns about its longer-term trajectory. Meanwhile, economists said the lingering energy crisis is expected to cause further recession in the eurozone this year. Economists said prices in the region will rise by an average of over 6%, and unemployment rate will increase from the current 6.5% to 7.1%, by the end of 2023. High inflation and energy shortages would lead to a further decline in production and worsen the situation in the labour market. Subsequently, by the end of the year, the eurozone economy will shrink by 0.01%. Chiara Zangarelli, an economist at Morgan Stanley, said, "Gas markets in Europe remain a key risk. Additional supply disruptions or a particularly cold winter could lead to renewed tensions and prices rising again, forcing another round of adaptation and demand destruction."
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
U.S. airstrikes in Somalia increased 30% in 2022 as the Biden administration increased U.S. involvement in the Horn of Africa country that is experiencing a new wave of fighting between the government and Al-Shabaab terrorists. In 2022, the Pentagon carried out 15 airstrikes on Al-Shabaab. According to data from the U.S. Africa Command, these strikes resulted in the death of at least 107 terrorists. The U.S. has conducted military operations against Al-Shabaab in Somalia since 2007. AFRICOM estimates the group has 5,000 to 10,000 fighters across the country of 15 million, controlling large swathes of land in southern and central Somalia. On Saturday, Somalia's government claimed for the first time that Al-Shabaab called for open negotiations with the government as it conducts a military offensive against the group it described as a total war. The uptick in fighting between al-Shabaab and government forces has come as the country experiences a fresh wave of attacks. This shows that the U.S. so-called counterterrorism military operations in Somalia have yielded few results. Despite the U.S. attacks, al-Shabaab has proven resilient and is still able to carry out attacks in the country. Al-Shabaab recently claimed responsibility for a twin suicide car bombing in Somalia's Hiran region that killed around 20 people. Last year was a particularly bloody one. More than 100 people died in October when two car bombs exploded at a busy Mogadishu intersection. In August, al-Shabaab launched a days-long siege on a Mogadishu hotel that left more than 20 people dead. In 2020, former U.S. President Donald Trump's administration moved to withdraw all 700 American troops from Somalia after a three-decade presence in the country. Soon after the Biden administration came into office, it reversed the Trump move. And in May 2022, U.S. officials said the president approved a plan to redeploy troops to Somalia. Some U.S. lawmakers have raised concerns about the U.S. military campaign in Somalia, which has been carried out on the grounds of the 2001 Authorization for the Use of Military Force, passed following the 9/11 terror attacks. Successive U.S. administrations have used the AUMF as a pretext to approve military action in countries like Afghanistan, Yemen, and Djibouti, despite no formal declaration of war by Congress. In December, Democratic Congresswoman Sarah Jacobs and Senator Elizabeth Warren sent a letter to the Pentagon arguing that the Defense Department was undercounting civilian casualties in Somalia. The U.S. Congress is the branch of the American government that has the authority to declare war. Despite Congress not having declared war in Somalia, the Biden administration has used the 2001 Authorization for the Use of Military Force to bypass restrictions. The 2001 AUMF has been used by successive administrations to justify military operations against a number of groups. In at least 19 countries, including Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, Libya, Somalia, and Yemen. Today, the authorization for the use of military force is the legal basis used to justify all current wars. For this reason, it is called the blank check for the endless wars. And while the Biden administration has signaled it supports ending the different 2002 AUMF specifically for Iraq, it has not shown any support for revoking the wider-ranging 2001 AUMF, despite calls from the lawmakers. In August, U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin lauded the country's military operations in Africa, saying it works alongside our friends as full partners to strengthen bonds, to tackle common threats, and to advance a shared vision of an Africa whose people are safe and prosperous. But a recent report from the Pentagon's Africa Center for Strategic Studies contradicts this. The report says terrorist group violence in Africa has risen inexorably over the past decade, expanding by 300% during this time. The U.S. has spent roughly $2.5 billion on security assistance for Somalia since 2009. It has also conducted at least 265 airstrikes since 2007. However, despite years of military presence in Africa, U.S. has failed to combat extremists and terrorists. The British royal family may appear to be prim and proper to the public. However, they have faced their fair share of controversies over the years. From the separation of Charles and Diana in 1992 and the famous comment of the late Princess of Wales that there were three of us in this marriage, so it was a bit crowded, to the Megxit when Prince Harry and Meghan Markle stepped down from their royal duties. Now, few years into the new year, the royals are on the back foot. The Duke of Sussex's tell-all memoir, with its bombshell revelations, has turned into a big challenge for the monarchy. Prior to the official publishing of the book, multiple media outlets reported they had secured copies of Harry's autobiography. Among the jaw-dropping claims is Harry's reported retelling of his scuffle with his brother, Prince William, in 2019, his use of cocaine as a teenager, and killing 25 people in Afghanistan when he was a helicopter pilot in the country. He also said he confronted discrimination and neglect from the royal household from a younger age. While Buckingham Palace has kept silent, Harry's revelations have drawn mixed reactions. Some have denounced Prince Harry's tell-all memoir for putting family arguments out there for the world to see. They say Harry's account will be damaging to the monarchy and undermines the king at a time when he is trying to show the institution is modernizing. Others say they sympathize with the sibling rivalry the prince describes and other elements of his experience. The fact is, the British monarchy is by its very nature hierarchical, and this has led to Harry feeling like his spare part. A former royal biographer has said he is perplexed by Harry's memoirs, saying it contains the kind of revelations you would expect from a B-list celebrity. Meanwhile, the royal analyst and biographer of King Charles, Catherine Mayer, has said Prince Harry's book could be the beginning of the end of the monarchy, given the lack of trust in the state at the moment. She said anger over racism, misogyny, and wealth in the royal family can undermine public consent for a monarchy. Survey results over the years show that younger people are less likely than older people to say that it is important that Britain has a monarchy. Indeed, just 14% of under 35-year-olds take that view compared with 44% of those aged 55 and over. This suggests support for monarchy will decline as today's older generation is replaced by younger Britons. Revelations in Prince Harry's newly published book include the murder of 25 people in Afghanistan while serving with the British Army in the country. The 38-year-old described killing targets as moving chess pieces, noting that he was not ashamed of doing so. High-profile British veterans have criticized Prince Harry and warned the high-profile admission could increase the risk to his personal security. Retired Army veteran Colonel Tim Collins said the prince's kill count talk was crass, and we don't do notches on the rifle butt. Others said Harry had appeared wrongly to dehumanize those he killed by describing them as chess pieces removed from the board. That's while the Taliban have accused the prince of committing war crimes on his military tour in Afghanistan. Abdul Qahar Balkhi, the spokesperson for the Taliban-led Afghan Foreign Affairs Ministry, described the Western occupation of Afghanistan as a horrible moment in human history, saying comments by Harry is a microcosm of the trauma experienced by Afghans at the hands of occupation forces who murdered innocent people without any accountability. Last year, an investigation revealed commandos in the UK's elite Special Air Service Corps killed at least 54 Afghans in suspicious circumstances during a six-month tour of Helmand Province from November 2010 to May 2011, but the military chain of command concealed concerns. The investigation found that unarmed Afghan men were routinely shot dead in cold blood by SAS troops during nighttime raids during the long war in Afghanistan, and weapons were planted on them to justify crimes. In 2001, the US and its close allies, including the UK, invaded Afghanistan under the pretext of fighting Al-Qaeda. The invasion preceded by over two decades of war in Afghanistan and cost 241,000 lives.
The United States has yet again imposed a fresh round of sanctions against the Islamic Republic. This time, targeting the country's suppliers of drones, Washington claims Russia has been using in the war in Ukraine. The sanctions targeted six executives and board members of Kursk Aviation Industries. The U.S. Department of Treasury said the group, which has been under U.S. sanctions since 2013, was a key Iranian defense manufacturer responsible for designing and producing drones. Washington said the drones have been used to target civilian infrastructure in Ukraine during the conflict with Russia. Among those designated was Said Hojatollah Qureshi, Quds Aviation Industries board chairman and senior official in Iran's Ministry of Defense and Armed Forces Logistics. The Treasury said Qureshi had led Iran's military research and development efforts and was responsible for negotiating Iran's agreement with Russia for the supply of the Iranian drones for the war in Ukraine. The Treasury also imposed sanctions on Qasem Damovandian, Quds Aviation Industries managing director and board member. It said he had likely facilitated the group's supply of drones to Iran's military services and the training of Russian personnel on the use of drones. The accusations come as Iranian officials say Ukrainians have so far failed to provide any evidence for their claim that Russia was using Iranian drones in its war on Ukraine. Speaking following a technical meeting between Ukrainian and Iranian experts, Iran's defense minister, Brigadier General Mohammad Reza Ashtiani, said the Ukrainian side had stopped short of presenting any evidence of Russia's use of Iranian drones in its war in Ukraine. Prior to that, Iran's foreign minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian had also reacted to the U.S. and other Western countries' allegations, noting that Tehran had provided Moscow with a limited number of drones, but the delivery had taken place months before the war in Ukraine. The sanctions come as the U.S. Treasury says it will continue to use every tool at its disposal to deny Russian President Vladimir Putin the weapons he is using to wage his unprovoked war in Ukraine. The Friday sanctions also targeted the director of Iran's Aerospace Industries Organization, which the Treasury claimed was the key organization responsible for overseeing Iran's ballistic missile programs. The move freezes any U.S. assets of those designated and generally bars Americans from dealing with them. Those engaged in certain transactions with the targeted individuals also risk being hit by sanctions. The United States has previously imposed sanctions on companies and people it accused of producing or transferring Iranian drones that Russia has used to attack infrastructure in Ukraine. Military-related sanctions on Iran are just a small part of the U.S. so-called maximum pressure campaign against the Islamic Republic. Washington has left no stone unturned in pressuring Tehran to fulfill its demands, given that the so-called maximum pressure policy has so far failed to produce the intended result. It is widely believed that by pressuring the government and subsequently the people of Iran, what the United States is and has been pursuing after 40 years of the Islamic Revolution is seeking regime change. The sanctions against Iran over its supply of drones to Ukraine comes as the West has itself been fanning the flames of the Ukraine war by providing billions of dollars worth of military assistance to Kiev. That includes the United States, Germany, France, and the UK. The weapons they provide range from mortar fighting vehicles and Leopard tanks like AMX-10RC armored combat vehicles and Abrams tanks. This is while providing Kiev with such weaponry could increase the risk of direct confrontation between Moscow and the West. Iran has been under the UN and US sanctions since the 1979 revolution. What comes to the spotlight is the futility of such all-out anti-Tehran measures. Despite 40 years of pressure and sanctions on the Islamic Republic, not only Iran has not stopped, but it has progressed, so the sanctions tactic has lost its effectiveness in a sense. This rather indicates that the United States seems to be escaping the frustration caused by its failure against the Iranian nation's iron will. The resilience of Iran's economy is not the only reason why the unlawful American maximum pressure campaign of sanctions against Tehran has failed. The maximum pressure policy against Iran was initiated by former U.S. President Donald Trump when he unilaterally pulled out of the Iran nuclear deal to strike a better agreement, which he hoped would restrict Iran's ballistic missile program and its influence in West Asia. Eventually, his hopes and aspirations became more and more far-fetched with each passing day. Now the Trump-imposed sanctions regime has been maintained by the Biden administration, although they realize it has been an abject failure. Could this be because they see no alternative course of action? What seems to be of very high significance is the fact that the Biden administration has realized that Trump's so-called maximum pressure campaign not only didn't work, but only helped strengthen the Islamic Republic of Iran in the international arena. Yet Iran stands. How so? Iran's economy and partners are diversified with initiatives to circumvent such U.S. measures.
Sheikh Abdulaziz bin Zayed's recent trip to Damascus was the second time he met with the Syrian President Bashar al-Assad as the two Arab nations continued to warm up to each other. The two top diplomats discussed restoration of relations and boosting of economic ties, with Assad saying that they will help regional stability and Sheikh Abdullah expressing support for a diplomatic solution to the conflict in Syria, as he was joined by a group of economic and security officials on his visit. Relations between Syria and the UAE were severed after Syria was expelled from the 22-member Arab League all the way back in 2011. The UAE reopened its embassy in Syria in 2018. Bahrain, Algeria, and Jordan have also resumed ties with Syria, while other Arab nations are calling for Syria's reinstation to the Arab League. This trend has not been sitting well with the U.S., as officials have slammed the visit by Sheikh Abdullah. One U.S. senator has even threatened the UAE with sanctions in a tweet in typical Twitter fashion. UAE's outreach to the Assad regime provides little benefits to the Emirates. This carries huge risks to UAE's reputation, exposes it to Caesar sanctions, and hurts efforts to seek accountability for Assad's crimes against the Syrian people. The Caesar sanctions refers to the Caesar Syria Civilian Protection Act of 2019, also known as the Caesar Act. It is a U.S. legislation that not only sanctions the Syrian government, but also any entity, organization, or individual that provides funding or assistance to it. Iranian and Russian entities have been sanctioned under this act. It follows a pattern in U.S.'s attitude towards its foreign relations. If they don't want to conduct business with a country, no other country should be allowed to either. Sheikh Abdulaziz had criticized the Caesar Act back in 2021 during a meeting with his Russian counterpart Sergei Lavrov. He said, "Bigger challenge today facing coordination and working with Syria is the Caesar Act," and further added, "To keep the Caesar Act as it is today makes this path very difficult, not only for us as a nation, but also for the private sector." To those comments, the U.S. replied that it would not ease up on its stances towards Syria, a stance they have maintained to this day, as apparent by their latest remarks surrounding the latest meeting between Turkish and Syrian officials. In the first time that Ankara and Damascus held talks among their high-ranking officials since 2012, defense ministers of both countries met in Moscow at the end of December. In that meeting, Turkish Foreign Minister Mevlut Çavuşoğlu said that he expects to meet with his Syrian and Russian counterpart later this month. This is a significant shift in Turkey's attitude towards Syria, as Ankara severed ties with the Arab nation back in 2012. And this shift has been met with a swift response from the U.S. When asked about the issue by reporters, Department of State spokesman Ned Price said, "We've made very clear to all of our allies and partners that now is not the time to normalize relations. Now is not the time to upgrade relations. Instead, in the eyes of the U.S., now is the time to impose further crippling sanctions on Syria, where the humanitarian conditions are deteriorating day by day, as the sanctions also include medicinal supplies." A UN special rapporteur on the negative impacts of unilateral coercive measures visited Syria and said that the sanctions have had catastrophic effects on the lives of Syrians as the country grapples with food and medicine shortages. She also said, "In the current dramatic and still deteriorating humanitarian situation, as 12 million Syrians grapple with food insecurity, I urge the immediate lifting of all unilateral sanctions that severely harm human rights and prevent any efforts for early recovery, rebuilding, and reconstruction." Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan said on Thursday that he may meet his Syrian counterpart as part of a new peace process in the wake of the country's defense minister's meeting. An Erdogan-Assad meeting will signal the official failure of U.S. attempts to topple the Syrian government through sanctions and boycotts, as it will show that U.S. allies are no longer listening to the will of America. It will cause embarrassment for the U.S., not quite on the level of their exodus in Afghanistan, but not too far off either.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood ghudde saratani Israel mukhalifim.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor, Israel. Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Terrorist attack in Shah Cheragh Shrine disgraced the hypocritical, black-hearted Americans. This is the part of Imam Khamenei's speech in the Imam Khomeini Hosseiniya on Tuesday, December 20, 2022, which was delivered when he met with a number of the families of the martyrs who were murdered in the Shah Cheragh terrorist attack. The tragic yet glorious tragedy that took place in the holy shrine of Ahmad ibn Musa Shah Cheragh, peace be upon him, is one that will remain permanently in history. The enemy's culpability in this case is different from many other acts of terrorism that have taken place inside the country. Sometimes they attack a military unit. On another occasion, they might target a political group. This is one matter. But then they attack a number of pilgrims. It is not a political gathering, nor is it a battlefield. It is a place for making a pilgrimage. It is a place for seeking nearness to Allah, to God. People went there from different places, from Tehran, from Hamadan, from Gilan province, from Shiraz itself, from Kokiluye and Boyer Ahmad province, to plead with God, to have a quiet moment with God, and to confide in the friends of God. Then they were attacked like that.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
The enemy was totally disgraced in this case. Who is this enemy? Is the one who committed this crime the only enemy? He obviously is an enemy. He is a criminal. He is a treacherous criminal. But he was not the only one. There were people who were backing him. They say it was the Daesh, ISIS. Well, yes, but who created ISIS or Daesh? Who created this dangerous creature? The U.S. has clearly stated that they created ISIS. They explicitly stated this. Not now. 7 or 8 years ago, they said they created Daesh. They are guilty, the ones who are holding up the flag of human rights. May God curse these black-hearted, wretched liars. They act in that way, but they speak in a different manner about human rights, the rights of women, and about various issues concerning humanities. They say one thing, but act in a different manner. They were disgraced. They are totally hypocrites. And a person who is a hypocrite is an unbeliever. And an unbeliever is God's enemy. They are God's enemies. Those people are unbelievers, hypocrites, and the enemies of God. They were disgraced in the tragedy that took place in Shah Cheragh Shrine.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Iruba Shavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
They took months to be held, but only hours to fail. Negotiations between unions and the UK government aimed at working out mainly pay deals to prevent another wave of public sector disruptions.
We are talking about people who are working well beyond their contracted hours anyway, just to get the job done, because they can't hand patients over and because they care so much. So for the government to be talking about productivity in exchange for a pay award is an insult to every single one of our members.
An insult to his union members and perhaps to other public sector workers across the country, protesting against the government's refusal to give them pay rises that keep pace with inflation, which soared above 10% in October last year. The same month, public sector pay in real terms hit a 19-year low.
Brexit has destroyed investment. It's led to us being a less attractive place for foreign direct investment as well. So, unfortunately, We got a lot of self-inflicted wounds, plus Ukraine, plus, you know, fairly incompetent government.
But the government is digging in. Instead of making concessions, it has introduced controversial new legislation to Parliament designed to curb the impact of the strikes. Critics of the new bill are warning of the consequences.
Once you start sacking people, people are more likely to even go on strike together. I mean, ultimately, this is so much against the trade union movement, they risk a national strike over it, because trade unions will gang together to make sure that they have an impact and stop this kind of legislation.
Without the desired pay offers from the government, those walkouts are bound to go ahead, with tens of thousands of transport workers, National Health Service staff, civil servants and others set to take part in industrial action this month and beyond.
There are more strikes in the UK today than in more than a decade, driven by a cost of living crisis and a lack of inflation-matching pay rises. The unions are saying enough is enough, and that the only way for them to cease further industrial action is hard, cold cash. It remains to be seen if the UK government will be the first one to blink in this staring contest. Saeed Pereza, London.
Families of prisoners and their advocates have staged a sit-in inside the office of the International Committee of the Red Cross in the blockaded Gaza Strip on Monday. Their action was in solidarity with thousands of Palestinian prisoners held in Israeli jails and detention centers. Tel Aviv practices apartheid policies against Palestinians in the occupied West Bank, Gaza, and Al-Quds. Among those apartheid policies is the bad treatment of Palestinian prisoners.
The prisoners are suffering tremendously inside Zionist jails, and we pray for their release. My son was only 17 when he was arrested and has been behind bars since 1992. He's a freedom fighter who fought for the liberation of Al-Quds and Palestine.
Palestinian prisoners who are held in 24 Israeli jails and detention centers are all denied basic human rights.
Prisoners' advocacy groups are calling